Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 244. Congratulatory rejoicing.
Mashidzamla means just barely not dead. But you have to be over 70 or late 60s, or they'll really give you a look if you try
to use that.
This is a great book. I like it a lot. I'm preparing to die.
Thanks for the plug. I appreciate it.
being very much alive is what it is.
Yeah.
Preparing to die is being very much alive. Did you ever read, Andrew, yourself, the Carlos Castaneda books? I always thought of Don Juan, whoever he really was.
Right.
I thought of him as Dilopa, actually. I don't know why. I thought, oh, this guy's Dilopa. This is Dilopa.
Yeah, nice.
I just felt this was emanation of Dilopa. I don't
know. Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
And I happen to know Castaneda's professor at UCLA.
Oh, wow.
Keith Bola was his name. And he told me he was sure there was such a person as Don Juan.
No kidding.
Because he said his graduate student never could have made it all up by himself.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. There's some real truth in that.
But then he did him a huge favor by rejecting his PhD thesis twice, and both books became bestsellers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then finally he decided he didn't want him to have a third bestseller, so then they accepted the final thesis. They didn't give him an academic job, on the other hand, but they accepted the thesis.
Yeah.
Really funny story. But I always thought Don Juan's teaching was very authentic. And he always had you keep death on your shoulder as an advisor.
Exactly. Use death as an advisor.
And death is always advising you of, like, don't waste your time on this and that and the other, and live at a certain level of intensity. Because death is on your shoulder, you know. I love that. I remember that from now forever.
Absolutely.
Okay, and we were just at the point when Yama was counting the black and white stones. The angels were in front of the poor Bardo being. Hey, noble one. Yes, then you will be very worried, angry, and terrified. Trembling, you will lie, saying, I committed no sins. But then Yama, the judge of the dead, will say, I will look into the mirror of evolution. When he looks into the mirror of evolution, all your sins and virtues will clearly and distinctly appear therein. Your lies will not help. Yama will tie a rope around your neck and lead you away. He will cut off your head, rip out your heart, pull out your guts, lick your brains, drink your blood, eat your flesh, and gnaw your bones. But since you cannot die, even though your body is cut to pieces, you revive again and again and again. Being cut up again and again, you will suffer immense pain. So when the white stones are being counted, don't be afraid. Don't panic, and do not lie. Don't fear, Yama. Your body is mental, so even if it is killed and cut up, you cannot die. In fact, your form is the void itself, so you have nothing to fear. Your form is emptiness, emptiness is form, right? Matter is void. Even subtle matter energy of the between body. Don't worry, you have nothing to fear. The Yama deities are your own hallucinations, and themselves are forms of the void. Your own instinctual mental body is void. Voidness cannot harm voidness. Signlessness cannot harm signlessness. You should recognize that there is nothing other than your own hallucination. There is no external, substantially existent yama, angel, demon, or bull-headed ogre, and so on. You must recognize all this as the between. Easier said than done, but do it. Meditate on the samadhi of the great seal. And that is feeling, that's again what I'm constantly harping on here, you know, is the trust in the universe, the trust in the lovingness of the universe, as the great seal means. You love it and it loves you. When you walk on the beach, I'm such an idiot. I walk there thinking, oh, it must be cold, or maybe I'll go swim, or can I catch a wave? Or maybe I won't, or I have to warm up in the sun first. Or I'm just thinking all sorts of silly, self-centered things, instead of realizing that those waves are the love of the earth, the water, the temperature, and the wind, expressing love for me and everybody else on the beach and all beings. Look at that beautiful palm tree and the ocean and the isthmus, peninsula. Really, we're all locked down and we see the beach. Thank you, Felicia. Okay, so now he says, meditate on the samadhi of the great seal. So that's the great seal. That sealed in my consciousness is the lovingness of the ocean and the palm tree fronds and the greenery and so on. Besides that, it's making up a bunch of coconuts so I can have some coconut milk in my tea. That's really nice. I like that. If you don't know how to meditate, examine carefully whatever terrifies you, and see the voidness that is its lack of objective status. So, okay. Every night we went to sleep. Every night we finally gave it up. We became unconscious. In order to do that, we surrendered our sense of boundary. Because we're completely vulnerable when we're unconscious. Talk about being vulnerable. When you're asleep, you're totally vulnerable. I mean, of course, you have the door locked and blah, 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 the windows closed and the dark and quiet. And blah. So, you know, you're trying not to be, but actually you personally are very vulnerable. If someone picked the lock or whatever, there's nothing you can do about it, whatever it is. And yet you wake up refreshed. So whatever happens to you while you're unconscious is nourishing. The universe nourishes you just by passing out. So why, what's this thing about nature, the world sucks? What is it? It's a mistake. People tell you that who think you have to look, get something from them. They want to sell you something, like some sort of religion or some sort of authority or some sort of anything. Because you need them because the world is untrustworthy. Look at that, you have proof. You say, look, I slept now. For 80 years, I slept every single night. I was 100% vulnerable half the time, or no, a third of the time for 80 years. I'm fine. I'm healthy. I'm alive. I woke up lots of mornings feeling like going in and out and feeling good. So somebody was loving me. I had some oxygen, still breathing. That was good. But I breathe in the daytime and I get more and more tired. So it isn't oxygen. The clear light of the void, that's what it is. Emptiness, clear light, diamond energy. Okay? And I'm too uptight to relax into diamond energy except when I'm unconscious. That's a real lesson to me. Okay, if you don't know how to meditate, examine carefully whatever terrifies you, lots of things, and see the voidness that is its lack of objective status. That is the natural body of truth. Nowadays, I like to say body of reality, with a capital R maybe, just to make the absolutist feel better. body of reality itself. And that voidness is not merely an annihilation. Therefore, when I'm looking at things, if I look for voidness, I'm just jumping straight to nihilism. But if I'm looking for things to really pinpoint what they are, they will dissolve under analysis. And my failure to really find the things that appear to me, that appearance is their ultimate status, or what concept, the appearance of their parts, their atoms, their subatomic particles, is their ultimate status. Any appearance will dissolve under analysis. And that is that failure to find that thing I put my ultimacy seeking, critical wisdom to work to find, the failure to find anything there is my recognition of voidness. But it's not an extra thing. It's just the not finding of the other thing. It isn't closing around a thing called voidness. Actually, the act of closing around a thing called voidness, the danger is that there will be maybe an experience of everything being space, floating into space, like a spaced out experience, which is a good experience because it's the sort of acknowledging the disappearance of whatever seemed solid before that I was examining and analyzing, including inside in the self, area of the self, or outside the area of things. And it all disappears under analysis. And then that state of disappearing somehow is experienced like an open space. And I fall into it, I melt into it, and everything else seems to melt into it, okay? And so the danger then is, oh, this is emptiness, as if it were something apart from the things. So for this, we need the remedy of matter is emptiness. Emptiness is matter. Emptiness is not other than matter. Matter is not emptiness, then not other than emptiness. You know, the Heart Sutra, that's our Prajnaparamita, the great transcendent wisdom teaching. It transcends relational things by examining and investigating there to find their ultimate reality. And then it transcends everything disappearing as if their ultimate reality was something without them. And when the disappearance of everything disappears, then everything is back. And now that is clear light as everything, body of reality, including space and what is in the space, all of it. No nothing, and not including nothing, because nothing is what isn't there. So you don't have to like redeem it, because you can't destroy it, because it isn't there. It never was created. And in a way, the emptiness also, so nothingness and emptiness share. Emptiness or voidness is also not created. It's also primordial nirvana. It's also primordial clear light. It's also what everything is or has always been. And so therefore, nothing should bother me. Okay? And the only thing that is sort of a this residual bother, although inconceivably somehow, while remaining totally aware of it, it doesn't bother the Buddha. But in a way, the fact that it bothers people who suffer, or beings who suffer, not just people, beings who suffer, is somehow draws the attention of the Buddha. And since he sees it's unnecessary, that suffering, it's only based on a misknowing, then he automatically becomes the awareness, and through building up from the infinite energy of clear light, he builds up a kind of resonance manifestation, animate or inanimate, human or non-human, whatever it might be, object or person, that will help that suffering being suffer less. That will be a therapist for that being, will be a healer for that being who's suffering without any effort at all. It just automatically happens. Amazing. And that voidness is not merely an annihilation. Your triumphant, distinct awareness of the terror of the void is itself the blissful mind of the body of beatitude. Ha! That's a challenging sentence. You're triumphant. Triumphant in the sense of sailing into the freedom and feeling free and reifying that freedom, projecting a sense of infinite space as that freedom, which of course being only there in that location, let's say, is not freedom actually. It's being trapped in this infinite space. But nevertheless, it feels triumphant because of breaking through, and then becomes more triumphant by breaking through having the spaciousness. So your triumphant, distinct awareness of the terror of the void, and the terror would be if you're sort of trapped in it, or you're mistaking that spaciousness as, well, there's nothing in this space as a kind of nothingness, and you may at first to free, and at second maybe it's like entrapping, is itself the blissful mind. So the awareness is the bliss. This is key. This is, of course, essence of unexcelled yoga tantra, or all tantra, actually. I don't know if you, I'm sure a lot of you know that already, but it was good to repeat. The key thing about tantric intuitions, or what the translators like to translate as gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis. And I think the word intuition is better, the English word, than just gnosis. Gnosis makes a mystifying thing. So the point is that the difference of emptiness of tantra and emptiness of sutra is not emptiness. That's not different. Voidness, selflessness, those are not different. They're the same. But the difference is the subjectivity that experiences it. And in the sutra, in the exoteric, it's the coarse mind that is on the edge of conceptuality, although it can break, it can sort of have a, feels like a direct experience, but say conceptuality is always hovering. Like when you float into, you know, infinite space, or you feel you become infinite space as more real than having been the body that you were in a relational space, then that means you have it like almost a visceral experience, but actually your conceptuality is operating invisibly to exclude all the other things in the space with you by having analyzed them all, and they all dissolved under analysis. So in a way, that's the coarse mind, although the coarse mind can break free of conceptuality. Its experience, its non-conceptual experience, is still subliminally aware of it, that it's non-conceptual, that it's different from conceptual, if you follow me. However, in Tantra, it's not that coarse mentality, because you've gone down to the subtle and you're aiming toward, you're trying to open up the onion, you know, layers or the petals of the flower of the super subtle, the indestructible drop, deepest clear light mind of your own. And you're trying to get there, kind of. And therefore, the bliss of the release into the freedom is what knows the freedom. There's no concept of freedom as conceptual or non-conceptual. And even perhaps, and this is something I'm really ecstatic about lately myself, even perhaps the duality between direct experience and inferential experience, rational experience, you know, inference, you know, knowing the fire is there, but only seeing the smoke. But at that point, there's no duality between knowing the fire and seeing the fire. At that point, maybe, I think so. Which in terms of Buddhist epistemology is a shocking non-duality, because they're very clear. Their epistemology is very, very clear about the difference of conceptual knowledge and non-conceptual experience, and the aim for non-conceptual experience of what is real, totally. And that's enlightenment, has to be like that, ultimately. But maybe it isn't just a casting off and a breaking past and a throwing away of conceptuality. That's why Buddha talks. He doesn't talk in one way, but he talks. And he he encourages people to reason and to use their intelligence. And so the move at the highest level from the conceptual to the non-conceptual is not a leap of blind faith of some kind of thing. It's coming face to face with the experience held there by the reason, by the concept. And the concept opens out beyond itself, but doesn't throw you, you know, in some anti-rational manner. So it's beyond duality of rational, anti-rational. That's really fascinating, I believe. And just think about it. Think about it, and therefore respect your intelligence and your common sense. And don't think that it's getting in your way. Too much Buddhism is taught, not just in the West either, West and East. Too much is taught. Oh, as long as you can somehow lobotomize your critical thinking, you'll be great, you know. And it's fine. And, you know, it's the difference between the pundit in Buddhist history and the siddha, okay? And it's like told in the story of Naropa, how he was sitting there. He was the head professor in the great Nalanda University, and he was reading a deep, profound book. And the cleaning lady came in, or a dakini, actually. A wisdom dakini came in pretending to be the cleaning lady, right, with a mop, you know. And she came in there, and she said, "Oh, hey, sonny boy, what are you doing there? Are you reading something?" "Yes, I'm reading." He says, "Oh, do you know, can you read the words?" And he's like thinking, you know, she's an illiterate lady. Yeah, I can read the words. And he says, "Oh, that's great." And then she says, "Do you know what it means?" And he says, "Oh, yes, I know what it means." He says, defensively. And then she starts going, weeping. She starts weeping. And then he gets so disturbed, you know, like, "Why are you weeping? You know, I'm the president of the university. I know what it means." She says, "No, you don't. You're the head of the university and you don't know what it means. And you're lying to me and to yourself." And then he's angry, like, but then he's Naropa, you know. So okay, maybe I don't know that deeply or something. Or maybe you're some strange person. I don't know who you are. He says, "Maybe not." Then he says, "Well, does anybody else know the meaning?" And she says, "Yeah, my brother knows the meaning." She says, "Your brother knows the meaning?" He says, "Yeah." "Well, where is he?" "Oh, he's off somewhere in the jungle." "What's his name?" "Oh, Telopa is his name. Telopa." "Oh, well, can I talk to him?" "No, you'll never find him. He's way off in the jungle," she says. And then he says, "Well, come on, I think I want to go find him. You must be some extraordinary creature there. So I'm definitely going to go find him. Which direction should I go?" "Oh, don't even bother to go any direction," she says. "You have to say the Chakrasambara mantra 1,000,000 times, and then maybe you'll be able to sense the right direction," she says. And then she says, "Well, I'm glad you at least have the, now you're confessing and you're honest. So bye." And then she turns into a rainbow and goes zoop out the window and drops her mop right on the floor. Great story. So then, you know, we misinterpret that story and we think, "Oh, Naropa was all trapped by being a great pundit. Then he went off and became a great siddha," as if became a siddha by not knowing anything and becoming stupid instead of smart. No way. You know, in Tibet, they have a name called Kedrub, just two syllables. That's the great thing about Tibet, short syllables instead of long letters. Multiple syllable names, Kedrup. And Kema means Pandita, and Drup means Siddha. So many Tibetan lamas and so many great Tibetan yogis were Kedrups. They were Pandita Siddha, if you had that expression in Sanskrit, you know, Pandita Siddha as one name, you know. Pansid, I don't know what, Pansida. And that's the ideal, is to be both, you know. And then Naropa also came back, and they called him back at the monastery once he was just living outside as a yogi, and the people at the monastery called him back because they were being overtaken by some outsiders who had really stupid theories. But you know, you had to defend your theory. You couldn't just be appointed by trustees in that university. The president of the university lived in the police box at the gate. You know, like those universities have a police box outside this and the street before you go in. That's like a guardian there, you know, a watchman. And that's where the president lived. And then anybody could go to that police box and demand to debate. And that's what the guy would do, would be debate with that person who came there. And then they could demand that the mayor or the police chief or the king or whoever it was, or send some judges. So it wasn't just a yes, no debate, but some were judges about the reasoning in the debate. And if that guy on the street could defeat the head scholar, who was the gate person, the gatekeeper, then he became the gatekeeper, and then he could change the curriculum of the university. And they had to follow that. So they were really reality-seeking university, not just some BS about having a big salary and tenure and fundraising like presidents do nowadays and run it like a business, you know. It was a teaching center, you know, really the, everyone seeking truth, you know, seeking reality. So then the Naropa came back, and then these guys who took control of the curriculum, they were saying all arguments, and he was struck dumb. He couldn't answer. You know, he was there as a yogi, but he couldn't respond. So then they were laughing, ha, ha, ha. You know, you called back your greatest pundit, but he's obviously become some kind of weird hippie, and he can't answer anything, can't even speak. So you guys have had it, and now start studying our theories. And then Dilipa suddenly showed up. And he said, just don't laugh so loud, you guys. This is my disciple, Naropa. And the reason he struck dumb is he made a vow to me that once he got into tantric area, into studying with me, he would not go around debating with people. Because, you know, then his speech is too strong and people would be upset and all this. So he wouldn't do it. He promised me. That's why he wants to answer, but his vow is stopping him from speaking. So, okay, Naropa, I give you just this one time the excuse to speak. So just answer their arguments. So then Naropa just, a giant lion's roar came out of his mouth, and they all fainted, and they took a break. And the lion's roar, of course, means teaching of emptiness, selflessness, and compassion. That's what lion's roar means. It's the sound of emptiness, you know? And it's undefeated, invincible. It's the invincible reason of relativity. All things are empty of any non-relational reality or any impartial absoluteness sticking in the middle of them, any of them, because they're totally relative, because they're empty of that. So, and they're all empty because they're totally relative. That's the thing. That's the lion's roar, actually. That should save you, you see. When you meet up something that seems absolute to you and frightens you or terrifies you or makes you suffer, when you meet that, you have to, the royal reason defends you because you say to yourself, and you get so used to it, you don't even have to make a sentence, an inner narrative, but you start with, you say to yourself, oh, because this seems so absolute to me, and because I'm seeing it, it's relative. Ha ha. So there's another option, whatever it is, always. Okay? So this, it becomes then the healing balm of emptiness, what they say. And therefore, although he also said, Nagarjuna said rightly, therefore someone who thinks they know that emptiness is something that they saw, or that they kind of own the experience of in their memory, or that it's a place there behind them or something like that, then that person who's stuck in emptiness can't help them. They become nihilistic, actually, that means. So, you know, if you ever hear someone say, oh, I can do whatever I feel like because I realize emptiness, and you shouldn't say anything because you don't know what it is, then they are wrong. They are making a mistake. Okay, so this is a great paragraph. So your triumphant, distinct awareness of the terror of the void is itself the blissful mind. The only terror is not the void, but that's all right to say that. But there's no terror in the void. The void is like down home, totally cool. So everything is relative, no problem. The terror is the threshold of the void, of the imminence state. of the 8 states that I told you about that you should try to look up in the books, you know, and or memorize and go run up and down them like an arpeggio, like you're learning the music, you know. And it's that liminal state is the dark light state, the immanent state. And then there is the fear of nothingness. And that's the terror. Oh, the abyss. Oh, I'll be nothing. Oh, I won't know what to do. Oh, no. I'll lose myself in there. I won't know who I am. Ah, I'll be crazy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's this feeling of loss of control. And that's the terror. And the voidness itself is nothing terrifying because it's everything. So, you know, voidness cannot harm voidness. You're just as void as anything you think is voidness looming up at you. Yourself, you already are. So nothing, it can't, the looming up itself is just another error, a misperception, a misknowing, okay? Please be clear about that. So your triumphant, distinct awareness is the triumph of bliss. The triumph of release. Oh, it's all me. It's all same. Oh, it's home. Oh, I've always been here. Oh, it's so nice. I feel so good. Oh, it doesn't hurt anything. It doesn't destroy a thing. It's always been so. Oh, my goodness. It's really me. It's the real me, actually. The blissful mind of the body of beatitude, which is your individual bliss at being one with everything. I know. It doesn't make any sense. It's very, very, whatever. Voidness and clarity. In a way, there's no grasping. You know, it's like water poured in water. You know, bliss, intense bliss, it melts you down, and then you just give it up. And whatever, you know, you let go. And there, and then reality embraces you, and you're there, still there, and you're there in this magnificently liberated and blissful manner. And then you can even tolerate all the irritating, annoying details as well, since others' misknowing seems to be continuing. Voidness and clarity are indistinguishable. The actuality of the void is clarity. The actuality of clarity is voidness. Your awareness of voidness, clarity, indivisible, is stripped naked. And now you abide in the unfabricated experience. That is the wisdom body of truth. And that spontaneously and unobstructedly arises everywhere. And that is the body of compassionate emanation, which is indivisible from, that's an infinitely alive in multiple embodiments and multiple forms. And you can be a flower arrangement yourself in front of someone who needs a flower arrangement to sort of open their paranoid, whatever it is. You can actually, you don't have to be a human being or an animal. You could be a pet. You could be a dog or a cat. You could be, if that person needs that, but you wouldn't be trapped as a dog or cat. You would simultaneously could be hundreds of other things. As I said, you know, the Buddha land, one of the metaphors I have for Buddha land is the John Belushi food fight universe. Okay? Because why? In this fight, in this world, the world of self-centered beings, not being moralistic about it, but just the world of self-centered beings is you look out for number one, you have your chocolate bar. In a Buddha verse, the air is chocolate, the ground is chocolate, the vapor, there's chocolate vapors everywhere. So it's like everybody's trying to throw their chocolate at everybody else. And you don't try to keep any chocolate, but everybody's throwing it at you. So it kind of gets smeared all over you. You know, so it's like everybody's out for every single one, in other words. So each one gives up being out for themselves, in a way, it doesn't bother. Because they're out for everybody. And so then it's like everybody has abundance because everyone is trying to give everything to everybody. And so it's recycling like really fast and you're getting smothered in chocolate if that's what you like. Right? So a food fight. That is the wisdom body of truth, which is indivisible from the beatific body of bliss, which is indivisible from the body of compassionate emanation, in the sense that that is the immediate enfolding and embracing of all beings to the degree to which they can tolerate whatever kind of embrace. Maybe they can only tolerate being under a palm tree and getting some oxygen from that palm tree, and then the occasional coconut milk. Okay. Hey, noble one, behold this without wavering. Recognize it. You will definitely become a Buddha, the perfection of the four bodies. Oh yeah, now they even have four bodies, usually three. But they divide into four when they make the subjective aspect and the objective aspect of the body of reality two different things. And they call the objective one the natural body of reality. And then they call the subjective one the intuitional, the intuitive or the experiential body of reality. But actually, since the experience is non-dual and subject-object merged like water poured in water, it's just an arbitrary conceptual overlay, really, of what is indivisible, right? But that's what it is. So, hey, noble one. But that's wonderful that here, even in the existence between, they have such a wonderful formulation of the oneness of oneself with Buddhahood and with all Buddhas, the perfection of the four bodies. Do not be distracted. This is the borderline between a Buddha and an ordinary being. Now is the time described as one instant alienated, one instant perfectly enlightened. That sounds like the power of now to me. Until yesterday, you were given to distraction. You did not recognize what arose as the between, and you were gripped by so much terror. If you again surrender to distraction, the cord of compassion will be cut, and you will go into the abodes that lack all freedom. So be careful. Thank you. So be careful. That was so kind. Thank you so much. So be careful. Hey, noble one, if you don't know to meditate thus, then remember and pray to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that is, to the teacher, to the reality and the teaching that leads one to the experience of reality, and the Sangha, which are those others who are either there or trying to get there along with you and your companion. Or they can say the Buddha is the doctor, the Dharma is the therapy, and the wellness that it believes in, the therapy guides you toward, and the Sangha are the nurses, they say, and the compassionate lords. Contemplate those are the angelic bodhisattvas. Contemplate all the terrors and visions as the compassionate lord, or your own archetype deity if you have a particular one you meditate on. Remember your esoteric initiation name and the spiritual teacher who gave you the initiations you received in the human realm. Proclaim them to Yama. Hey, Yama, I'm Moghavajra. I'm Akshobhyavajra. Don't bug me, you know. But Yama, the Lord of Truth. And they call him Dharmaraja. Actually, one of Yama's names is Dharmaraja, Reality King. You won't be injured because, why? Because Buddha tamed Yama. One form of Buddha is called Yama Antaka, the terminator of Yama, or the death of death, the killer of death. Now, if you destroy death, what do you have? Endless life, right? But you don't just go endless life, and pretend death isn't there. You eliminate death, and then you embrace death, and then you turn it into non-death. And so Yama becomes a great teacher, actually. And actually, we see it in the Upanishads. Okay, so hey, noble one, if you don't know how to meditate thus, then remember and pray. I said, yeah, so contemplate all the terrors. Oh, yes, it's your own. So remember your name and spiritual teacher who gave you the initiations you received in the human realm. Proclaim them to Yama, the Lord of Reality, the Lord of Truth. You won't be injured even if you fall off cliffs. So abandon fear and hate, fear and anger. Give it up. The present visions will propel you into the hardship of the changing states of pleasure and pain, as if flung by a catapult. So do not become absorbed in any visions of love or hate. Even when you are about to be born in the higher estates, when the visions of the higher estates arise, those are the different heavens, should the relatives you have left behind begin to make sacrifices with the slaughter of living beings, in case they're still doing that, to dedicate them to the Lord of Death, you will have many impure visions and begin to feel fierce anger. So if the relatives do some foolish rituals like that, this is showing that this still happened in Tibet in those days. I don't think almost at all now. Maybe some pockets, but almost nowhere. But the Burn tradition that used to do that maybe in the older time, now they are what's called, they don't do it. A good Burn doesn't do that. They're just like the Buddhists. They really are Buddhists. Actually, that's the thing about Tibet. Tibet is so Buddhist that even the non-Buddhists are Buddhists. Okay? That's the fact, you know. They really are. Conditioned by that, you will be reborn in hell. So no matter what actions are committed among the surviving, do not become angry, but contemplate love. Or if you yourself have great attachment to the wealth and possessions you left behind, or if you know that others are using your possessions, you will feel attached to them and angry at the people who are using them. Conditioned by that, even though you might have attained a high state, you will be reborn in hell or in the Pratan realm next, in other words. You might hit some deity plane. And this was one thing I just recently learned reading through this, is the connection, because that's why is that important? To really get the first noble truth, the truth of suffering of the unenlightened, any unenlightened state, the hardest thing is to realize the suffering of the gods of the heavens and not crave the heavenly estates by realizing that they have their own suffering. And that's the key to their suffering, is their impermanence. And because they do have actual pleasure, what seems like pleasure, which seems really long to them also. Or those who are power fanatics, they feel very macho, you know, like Venice Beach, weightlifting, killing, whatever they like. And then their victims jump up again and they can fight all over again. So they go on and on with it. And they occasionally lose, but never mind, they jump up again. So, but then they fall. And then I think the formless realm people fall to the animal states. The pleasure heaven people fall to the preta states. And the power people, the violence people fall to the hells. I think that I never quite realized it's so actually really clear here. And so that's the suffering of the heavens, is they're a little bit, they're sort of the glide path toward the horrible states. It's very hard to go to the horrible states from human, because we're so sensitive and vulnerable. We want to avoid horrible things maximally. We have maximal awareness to do so. But then we're tempted to go to what seem to be the powerful and pleasant states. But those are just doorways, and we'll have some moment there, but then there'll be doorways. And you know, even a long period of time is really short when it's over. I think you may have noticed that by now, some of you. So conditioned by that, therefore, even if you are attached to your old possessions, you have no power to own them anymore. They are of no use to you at all. Abandon fondness and attachment for your possessions left behind. Totally throw them away. Be decisive. Whoever uses your things, don't be stingy. Let go of them in your mind. Generate a one-pointed will to offer them to the spiritual teacher and the three jewels, and abide in the experience of detachment and unconcern. So that's another great thing about Indian civilization. In the four states of Indian civilization, even before moksha was a big deal, you know, emancipation, release, you know, before Buddha's time, but still they had, you know, student, householder, retreatant, a retiree, and then they had what they called sannyasin, meaning complete, hospice liver, someone who just gives it all away and goes out completely penniless and just goes out to rejoin the elements, you know, in nature. And if they, you know, will accept food if someone gives them, but They just become totally destitute on purpose to prepare for dying. And then therefore they have nothing to regret and they are able to become alive to their death process. Sannyasin, it's called, you know, the full scale renunciation. And it's a wonderfully wise culture. So take refuge. Don't respect them and protect your most positive attitude upon them. Then whatever your dear ones do for you will definitely help you. Such keeping of a positive attitude is very important to do it without forgetting. Again, if you're heading for rebirth in the three horrible states, when the visions of the horrible states arise, when you see the pure, it must be awful. Like, say, the animal state. You're in the barda there, and suddenly you're like on all fours, and you're galloping along in a stampede along with a bunch of other terrified wildebeests. Oh, my goodness. You're in that drama, galloping like the buffalo heading off a cliff in the days when they were hunted by the native people. Oh, my goodness. But this is still only in the barda, so you can actually swerve out of that. Luckily, and he's going to talk about that, I hope. I think so. He says, okay, when you see the pure virtue unsullied with sins performed by your surviving relatives, and when you see the perfect physical, verbal, and mental practices of your spiritual teachers and mentors, then when you are compelled to rebirth, your feeling of great delight has the invaluable benefit of lifting you up into the higher estates, just as you're about to be reborn in the horrid states. That's right. You know that one of my great teachers, the Lama Tara Tulku, the abbot, former abbot of Goethe Upper Tantric College, he was so wonderful, and he would wax eloquent about the practice of congratulatory rejoicing, anumodana, you know, jesu yidanwa, it's called in Tibetan, and this means, you know, somebody does something great, they jump over the 8-foot high jump or whatever. They run under the 4-minute mile, they do whatever, and then you say, I rejoice, I congratulate, it's wonderful what you did, and you sort of purge away any trace of begrudging. Oh, well, maybe you had special help, or, oh, maybe you were drugged, or, oh, maybe this, or oh, maybe you know, I could do something even greater, eh? Little envy, jealousy, begrudgingness that we tend to do, right? About anybody, they do anything, because we're trained or we're miseducated to be rapidly competitive with everybody about everything, you know? And so it's hard to really feel joy at someone else's success. It's sort of a little lint of, well, maybe not so great, you know? Happens very fast. So congratulatory rejoicing, really full scale, vicariously participating, enjoying your triumph is my triumph. I love it. It's marvelous. It's, you know, everyone should enjoy, you know, recognize it and blah, blah, blah. That practice is the lazy man's way of collecting virtue. And you didn't jump 8 feet and you didn't do this or that or whatever it is. But by really enjoying the person who does and genuinely joining in it with them, you get a little share of the merit of doing it as if you did it yourself. And here's a case where that really does you in good stead. Because you're in a stampede, being ready to go off the cliff into the abyss of a dumb level of existence where you would not have much freedom, much leisure, much liberty to plan a high evolutionary benefit or evolutionary progress. And you'd just be reacting to situations subsistently. And yet you turn your little antelope head or your buffalo head and you see your old guru levitating, shining with light, expressing love for all beings, whatever. Oh, that's so great. And by seeing that, boom, you could be lifted right out of the herd. In that moment, because everything is so unstable, you see. There's where Taro Rinpoche's great teaching really works. And of course, he always then would warn, say, and therefore be careful in these Western movies, like those movies about bank robberies. Although they should, okay, you're robbing a casino, they're already mafia or criminals, okay, so you feel better, but you're still robbing. Then you are compelled, I love this, you are compelled to rebirth. Your feeling of great delight has the invaluable benefit of lifting you up into the higher estates, just as you are about to be reborn in our estate. And of course, the greatest higher estate is the human birth, the human life, in a society where there have either are Buddhas or have been Buddhas, where the residue of the Buddha through teaching and text is still there, where you are in a family where they will have the means so that you can become educated and you will have the leisure to pursue the education to develop true insight and wisdom from your learning and your self-cultivation and et cetera, et cetera. In other words, that's the highest estate. Those are higher than the heavens. There's a few heavens where they have Dharma centers, like Tushita. That's a good one, because Maitreya is there. He has like a big Dharma center there. He has a big mega Dharma center in the Tushita heaven. But there are also deities there who are just goofing around, because it's a heaven. You know, Tushita means satisfaction, satisfied, heaven of satisfaction. It's the fourth up in the desire realm. You know, each one has specific qualities. Very carefully described by psychonauts. And when you are compelled to rebirth, oh, your delight, that's really great. So be very careful, as it is so important for you to construct a positive attitude of reverence and faith and not allow any place for impure negativity of perception. Hey, noble ones, in short, since your presence between consciousness is highly unstable, volatile, and mobile, and virtuous or vicious perception is very powerful, don't think at all about any unvirtuous evolution, and remember your own virtuous practice. If you have no virtuous practice, then adopt a positive perception anyway, and feel faith and reverence. Pray to your archetype deity and to the Lord of Compassion, whatever you call him. With intense willpower, perform this prayer as follows, and then we recite together. Now that I wander alone without my loved ones, and all my visions are but empty images, may the Buddhas exert the force of their compassion and stop the fear and hate-drawn terrors of the between. Now when I suffer by the power of negative evolution, may my archetype deities dispel my suffering. When reality crashes with the thousand thunders, may they all become Om Mani Padme Hum. When I'm pulled by evolution without recourse, may the Lords mild and fierce dispel my suffering. When I suffer due to evolutionary instincts, may clear light bliss arise for me. Thus perform this fervent prayer. It will surely guide you on the path. It is crucial that you decide. It is sure not to let you down. So then, okay, when you say this, the deceased should become aware, recognize the light, and attain liberation. We can do that anytime, you know. If you think about, you know, we can, that's the kindness and the great gift of the materialist scientists, even though I refute their pretend to reject the existence of the mind and former and future life, et cetera, and the continuum of mental energy. Even though I do, I deeply respect and admire them. And their reductionism gives us a model, a template of something very amazing that we can do, where you can meditate about yourself and you can first recognize that you think your flesh and blood, skeleton upholding muscles and tissues and nervous system and chakras inside and brain and et cetera, and limbs and digits and so forth. And that's you. But then you stop to think, well, wait a minute, if I went to a physics class, biology class, there would be all these cells, and the microbiome has like a billion people hanging out. So this is me. I mean, it's like a huge seething community. Talk about community. And then, okay, forget the biologist, head for the physicist. Then wait, there's molecules, and the cells are made up of molecules. Then the molecules have atoms, and the atoms have, then there's DNA molecules, and then there's RNA, DNA, and all kinds of codes completely invisible to me. And then an atom itself is only a little nucleus. And then it has a little electron spinning way out in the bleachers, far away from the nucleus on home plate. And so it's mostly empty space with things buzzing around in them. That's really me. They said that the uncertainty principle, there's nothing objective there at all. And then, but wait, maybe there, but they don't say there's nothing actually. They just said they couldn't find anything. And the looking even caused a disruption in whatever may have been objectively there. So they don't say that because obviously nobody's going to find nothing there. They just didn't find what they were looking for. And then there's all this dark and dark matter. So the point is we can do that reductionism. And then we can reach a place, though, where we're just pure light. We already are light. We are light, actually. And remember, the light is not a particle. Light is just and it's everywhere. And that's what we are. Because there's no room for anything other than that, actually, really, just light. And then our misknowing carves it into different things, or our awareness of other residual interconnection with others who are misknowing, and we carve that into different forms of light, and then they themselves make themselves ever more coarse and solid in order to feel secure, although that's having the opposite effect. In fact, they're feeling less secure by doing that, but they do it because it makes them think they're going to be secure. And but we are already light, in other words. That's a really good meditation. You can do that anytime.
Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part by the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the audiobook edition of Professor Thurman's translation of the Book of the Dead, please visit the links in the podcast description or visit his website at bobthurman.com. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.